This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition, our focal point is the November 13 White House visit by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and more broadly, the state of relations between Turkey and the West, especially NATO, as Turkey more closely engages Moscow on several key points. One is Turkey's joint mission with Russia on the Syrian border, displacing Kurdish forces that have held parts of northeast Syria, and also Turkey's changing defense posture, evidenced by its recent acquisition of the Russian S-400 anti-aircraft missile system, a move that caused the United States to suspend Turkey's involvement in the U.S. F-35 advanced fighter program. Turkey is the only NATO member to purchase and deploy the Russian missile system, a move some defense analysts say evidences Ankara's desire to leverage East versus West. Hello, I'm VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel. With us to define and discuss the situation are two seasoned analysts of Turkey in the Middle East, Dr. Graham Bannerman, who is affiliated with the Middle East Institute and the U.S. Institute for Peace, both in Washington, and Dr. Aykan Erdemir with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Good to be here.
Let's look at the November 13 White House visit by Turkish President Erdogan. What do you think are the key highlights and takeaways from that visit? Aykan, what do you think?
I think Erdogan's key interest was for this to be a public relations win, and possibly he might have walked away with that. You know, he got an audience, quite a long audience with President Trump. He had a press conference. He has demonstrated to audiences back at home and in the West that he is still welcome in the West after his cross-border operation into northeast Syria and the alleged war crimes committed by his proxies. I don't think there was much he was able to take away concerning sanctions, the S-400 air defense system, and the Halkbank trial for Iran sanctions evasion.
Dr. Bannerman, what do you think?
Well, I think there is an attempt by the administration to keep a relationship up with Turkey despite serious problems. I think, you know, the problem is if you turn foreign policy over to Congress, Congress basically has two things it does well. One is nothing, and the other is overreact. And if you turn the policy over to Congress, they would overreact and impose things and destroy the relationship between Turkey and the United States. I think the relationship is seriously strained right now. It's troublesome, and the future is in question. And I think what the president wanted to get out of it was to show the Turkish government that we still want to work with them, but that we still have serious differences. I don't think they went anywhere near resolving the differences.
There's an American slang term called frenemies, where you're friends with someone, but maybe you're not. Either one of you like to take that on it in this context?
Definitely. You know, Turkey is a longtime NATO ally, and as President Trump said, with the second largest army. But under the Islamist ruler Recep Tayyip Erdogan's leadership, Turkey has increasingly pivoted away from the transatlantic alliance and its values. And the S-400 air defense system that is being purchased from Russia is just one sign of that. But also in northeast Syria, we have seen how the interests of Ankara under Erdogan has clashed with that of not only Washington, but also with other allies in the European Union. And I think this is a trajectory which is unlikely to reverse in the near future, because Erdogan's personal political survival interest requires this adversarial action and rhetoric against the West, not just the U.S.
Why is it that in terms of Syria, obviously the incursion by Turkey into Syria to go in 30 kilometers deep, the idea was to create a so-called buffer zone, but in reality it was to drive out Syrian Kurdish elements, the very same people who have been the tip of the spear in the fight against ISIS in subduing the Islamic State in northeast Syria. What do you think?
Well, I think, in fact, the president realized something, that it was almost inevitable that the Turks were going to move into northern Syria so long as that territory was controlled by the Kurdish parties there. I think the government in Ankara and the people of Turkey believe that the Kurdish groups in Syria were a basic threat to their national security. Whether it's valid or not, that's a different issue, but they believe that. And the only way that they could see letting the Turks move in there, or the other option they had, was to let the Syrian government move into those areas. And that is a bigger threat to American interests than the Turks being there.
What was very interesting in the joint statements that were made by both presidents after their meeting, there was a revision made to President Erdogan's statements after this was already filed. Department of State offered an updated English translation for this portion of President Erdogan's remarks, and this is very telling and significant, and I wanted to share this. Quote, "There is no place for the terrorist organizations in the future of our region, particularly taking YPG-PYD terrorist organization as an interlocutor in the region, regardless of whichever country it is definitely inconsistent with the agreement that has been reached at a global level." Would someone like to explain or somehow define what he was saying there?
To be frank, I'm puzzled what exactly the Turkish president is referring to, but this is a repeat of the Turkish talking point that there is no difference between the designated Kurdish insurgent group, the PKK, and that of the YPG and the political wing PYD, and hence the umbrella organization Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, and hence its political wing, the Syrian Democratic Council, SDC. I think this is a maximalist position that Ankara is pushing, that all of the umbrella organization in northeast Syria, all members of that organization are one and the same with the PKK. And this, of course, is the road to, I think, nowhere, because ultimately Turkey needs to find some interlocutors in northeast Syria to find a lasting peace.
And who would those people be?
If you look at Syrian problem, this is not really a Turkish problem. It's how do you resolve the Syrian issue here? And this is what we're talking about. In the long run, what Assad has said, and the government, which is very clear, is that the Syrian government needs to have control of all of the borders of the country, and the Syrian government influence has to spread throughout the country, which means ultimately the Syrian government has to replace the Turks in the north and get control of Idlib province again. That's what the Syrian government position is, and that's what the Russians have supported. I think what they see, and the negotiated agreement between the Russians and the Turks was it limited the area in which the Turks would occupy and expanded the area in which the Russian-supported Syrian government forces would occupy. So therefore, it was a step in that direction from the Syrian government point of view. From the American point of view, we don't like to see either of those things happening, and that's a problem for us. We are isolated from the main part of the discussion. We find ourselves in the region right now not talking to various people who are important players. How can you talk to the Syrian settlement if you don't talk to the Syrian government and you don't talk to the Iranians? That's where the Americans find themselves. That's one of the reasons why the Russians have become the interlocutors there, is because they still talk to everybody in the region and they have a role to play. We have written ourselves out of that picture.
I would argue that this was evident all the way back from the summer of 2012, when the Assad regime and Russia set a trap for Turkey to fall into. And that was withdrawal of the Syrian Arab army, the regime forces, from Kurdish majority areas. And they knew very cunningly that there will come a day when Erdogan will say, I would rather have Assad to control these areas than the Syrian Kurds. And this is what happened after more than 7 years, when Erdogan fell into that trap and said, you know what, I would rather have Assad and his Russian backers to control this area rather than a self-governing northeastern Syrian entity, an enclave, to come into existence.
I think you are giving the Syrian government more credit for cleverness than they actually have. I think they were scrambling in 2012 to 2014 just to survive, and they didn't have the ability to make those conscious decisions. That said, I think the end result is exactly what you said. They're going to come to the conclusion that the Assad government is better there than the alternatives, which is not what the United States wants.
But could there actually be a role at this point for the United States to play? Just to follow up from your earlier discussion, I would argue definitely, meaning the U.S. was already playing a mediated role between Ankara and the Syrian Democratic Council. And let's remember that we're not just talking about Kurds. We're also talking about Yazidis, Syriac Christians, Armenians, and Arabs and Turkmen who also live in the region and who are also part of the SDC. And one positive example we have seen of the West playing a mediating role was when the French President Macron brought the PYD, the Kurdish political party in northeast Syria, together with the Kurdish National Council, the pro-Barzani, pro-Turkey Syrian Kurds. Right. And that was a very constructive step, which unfortunately failed. But that, I think, should have been the path for the European Union and for the U.S. to play, find ways of bridging this big gap between Ankara and the major players in northeast Syria.
Speaking of big gaps, how, since you study Turkish media and how Erdogan and the Turkish government speaks to its people and how they react to it, we had a situation that lasted for years where Turkey was literally a sieve for the Islamic State and other non-state actors, bad actors, just flowing through Turkey to go into Syria to take part in the Islamic State. So Turkey essentially was an open pathway for a bunch of bad actors, non-state actors. Then all of a sudden we have the rise of the Syrian Kurds, and they fight and essentially subdue the Islamic State. Then, of course, we have the Turkish incursion 30 kilometers into Syria, the very people who drove the Islamic State out to drive them away from the border. Now, if I'm just a Turkish citizen reading the newspaper or watching the TV, I'm getting a very conflicting thing here where my country was the open pathway for all of this to happen. And then the people who solve the problem are the very people that my government attacks. What am I missing here?
Now, if you were a Turkish citizen watching all this from the Turkish media, you're only getting one piece of news, that Erdogan is the great leader who is getting Turkey to a better place. So the average Turkish citizen has little idea about the negligence and complicity of successive Turkish governments in the mess that Syria is in today. But at the same time, when we take a look at the latest opinion polls to see what the people are really feeling, we see that 79% of Turkish citizens are behind the cross-border operation into northeast Syria, which I think proves the fact that Erdogan does manage to shape the public perception pretty successfully.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Dr. Graham Bannerman with both the Middle East Institute and the U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington, and Dr. Icahn Erdemir with the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Today's VOA Encounter program focuses on the Wednesday, November 13 visit to the White House by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and what appears to be a change in relationships between Ankara and the West, especially NATO, by moving apparently closer to Moscow in some aspects. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or you can connect with Encounter on Facebook. Here's a big shout out from one of our listeners, Facebook follower Zach Waku from Abuja, Nigeria. If you want to hear your own name and country on this program, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com, or on Facebook, give us a like and leave us a comment. Now let's get back to the discussion on Turkey, NATO, the West, and Moscow. You know, historically, Turkey has leveraged East versus West to its own advantage. This goes back to the formation of the Turkish state, the 1920 Treaty of Sevres, which established a separate nation for Kurdistan and for Armenia. And of course, Kemal Atatürk wasn't happy with that arrangement because, as he said so many times, there is only a singular Turkish identity, and therefore these other ethnic groups don't exist. There's only the Turkish identity. So he makes friends with Moscow. In 1921, the Treaty of Moscow is inked between Atatürk and Vladimir Lenin. This, of course, unsettles the western half of Europe because Bolshevism is not just in Russia, it's all the way through Europe. So what does he do? He looks for the West to solve his problem, and it was. In 1923, the Treaty of Sevres was superseded by a new pact, the Treaty of Lausanne, in which the signatories made no provision whatsoever for separate Kurdish and Armenian states. My point to both of you gentlemen is this. Would you say that Erdogan is using the same traditional playbook as Atatürk?
I think what's been lost in the conversation is that the Turkey today is a very different country than Turkey was 30 years ago. The dominant view in Turkey is fundamentally different of the world. And I think it's a mistake that when talk about things today, we try to treat Turkey the same way. I can remember in the 1990s, the effort of the United States made to get Turkey to be a member of the European Union. That's where we thought Turkey was heading. We thought Turkey was going to be a vital player in what the European identity is. There has been a change in the Turkish population and a change in Turkey's policy to reflect a non-European European point of view. And what we need to do is not focus on the disagreements of the moment, but how do you develop a relationship with this country that's very different from what it was in the past? And I say this with unhappiness, because I've always viewed Turkey as a great place to be, very much like ourselves. But it has drifted away from that, and the United States and the Turks have to decide what type of relationship can you have in the future between this very different country. Does it really belong in NATO? Is it really part of Europe? And what happens if it doesn't do that? Where do you go with the relationship? And I give President Trump credit for this. At least he has tried to keep a relationship out there, but the problem is we don't have the backup to say, have the discussion with the Turks, where do we want the relationship to go in the future?
Dr. Erdemir, is this the kind of relationship, the current relationship, that is optimal for the United States and for Turkey?
Now, I would characterize the current relationship as a transactional one, which is not necessarily based on trust, but which is just based on these one-off trades between two leaders. So it is also a very interpersonal relationship. And when we take a look at the history of Turkish-US relations as well as Turkish-NATO relations, those relationships have always been founded on strong institutional links. But now that Erdogan has consolidated power to a great extent in Turkey, we can safely speak about a one-man rule in Turkey, which has sidelined all of Turkey's institutions, all of Turkey's diplomatic tradition and human resources. Hence, here we are, a very transactional, personal relationship that does not do justice to the depth of this relationship. And also, it's important to keep in mind that even when there were disagreements in the past between the US and Turkey, even when Turkey tried to leverage its relations with Soviet Russia or then Russia, it was never this way, meaning Turkey was still at core committed to the transatlantic alliance, to transatlantic values, and was still moving inch by inch toward the West. But at this point, under Erdogan, I think we see that there is now a new Turkey in the making with Erdogan's social engineering. And it's not just the Erdogan circle, but almost half of the Turkish population that now see a future as part of the authoritarian bloc of countries to the East.
Dr. Bannerman?
I see also some of the policies of Turkey that are actually very harmful American general interest in the region. And this is, makes me very nervous. For example, I see them harboring the Muslim Brotherhood organization and the fact that they are promoting these views that go to undermine some of our most strategic allies in the region, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the like. This is where I see is the greatest harm Turkey is doing. And we need to find a way to direct a different policy, or we're going to have a confrontation on this issue. Because in the end, if they are successful undermining our allies in the region, American interests will be deeply harmed by Turkey's policy, not just marginally, like in Syria, but in major countries that are vital to our national interest.
I completely agree with this point. It's, I think, very important because Turkey has become a problematic actor on both the Sunni radical and the Shia radical side of politics, because it has helped Iran evade sanctions. It has harbored Hamas. It has harbored Muslim Brotherhood elements. And Istanbul is now home to these TV channels that incite violence in Egypt. So across the board, we have seen Turkey turning into a permissive jurisdiction for illicit finance and terrorism finance and various Sunni and Shia radical jihadist organizations, entities, and individuals have exploited this permissiveness. And I think this is where Turkey does the most harm to its NATO allies.
Sanctions invasion. Bring up and detail the Halbank situation here, because I think that's very relevant to this conversation.
I think people have missed this big story back in the 2013-2014 period, when at the height of U.S. sanctions against Iran, of all the countries, it was Turkey. And of all the banks, it was a state-owned bank, Halk Bank, Turkey's second largest public lender, that helped Iran evade sanctions to the tune of $20 billion. And to this day, Erdogan has been defiant in his commitment to evading Iran sanctions. He has basically stood behind all the individuals, all the ringleaders of the sanctions evasion network. And as we speak today, there is now a court case in the Southern District of New York where Halk Bank is being tried, but they refuse to be served. So this is, again, some evasive tactics on the part of the Turkish government that we witness in New York. But I would argue, again, a path to disaster when it comes to bilateral relations.
Halk Bank specifically was characterized as gas for gold, correct? So there was a gas shipment, obviously, that was facilitated through Turkey, and there was compensation made to Iran by Turkey, correct?
The way it worked was this. There was a humanitarian exception. That is, Iran could still export gas and oil, but only use the proceeds in an escrow account for humanitarian reasons, for food and medicine and other necessities. But the Turkish government helped Tehran get that money first as gold and then in other ways to be used for Iran's other nefarious purposes. And I think this started as gas for gold, but when the U.S. Congress closed that loophole, then it turned into false invoicing and other basically illicit tactics.
Let's go to the immediate foreground and look at the Russian acquisition of an S-400 anti-aircraft missile system. When you get a missile system, it's not like you're getting something from IKEA. You don't get a big box full of parts and an instruction sheet. When you get an advanced anti-aircraft missile system like an S-400, you not only get the transporters and the missiles and all of the equipment that goes with it, but you also get Russian technical advisors. May we use the word spooks? These are Russians who are involved with the military delivering a missile system to a NATO ally. In order for that missile system to work for the Turkish military, it has to be integrated into the Turkish defense structure. By integrating it into the defense structure, what they're really doing is opening a door into how Turkey's side of NATO is run and conducted, etc. There's a real window that I see. By bringing in this missile system, you're giving the Russian quote-unquote technical advisors essentially carte blanche to go into the whole defense structure of the country because they come with the missiles.
I think there is no question that when you get a major weapon system in from any country, those people are brought into your country and they get more access than they had before. Clearly, the Turks do not want the Russians penetrating their system, and they'll do everything they can to prevent that from happening. They don't want us penetrating their system. They don't want anybody penetrating their system.
How?
They do it. They can find them. But the problem is, you have to look at American policy. The key to American policy success in the region since the end of the Cold War has been the dominance of the sale of American equipment throughout the region. But the United States, through its use of this sales as an instrument of pressure upon various governments, not just Turkey, throughout the region, has brought those governments and Turks along with them to look to diversify their source of equipment. And this is what's happened, and Turkey's doing the same thing. They're diversifying their source of equipment because they're overwhelmingly dependent upon NATO and particularly the United States for their equipment. And they did not see that in their interest. That's what brings us back to the basic question. What type of NATO ally is Turkey going to be in the future, and how do we want them to be that? They're still heavily dependent on American equipment. And it's very important to them, but they don't want to be solely dependent, defend their own national interest.
On that issue, I think there is one very peculiar strategy on the part of Ankara, and that is, why did they not choose a European system, namely the Eurosam, to diversify their equipment and turn to Russia, a major adversary for NATO? In fact, the risk here is twofold. On the one hand, yes, we have all these Russian technicians on Turkish soil, but what I see as a bigger threat is that as we speak today, there are Turkish officers being trained in Russia. And as Russia builds compromat files on these officers to use against them. Furthermore, once the radars are turned on these S-400 systems, they will be collecting data on all flight patterns on Turkish airspace.
Exactly.
And as well as stealth data of the F-35 jets if they happen to be cooperated in the same space. So ultimately, I think I call this the worst foreign and security policy move of the Turkish history. It's a self-defeating move. It will not lead to transfer of technology or co-production with Turkey's Russian partners. And the opportunity costs are great because both with the Patriots and with the Eurosam systems, Turkey could have been not only a customer, but also a future partner in co-producing these air defense systems.
Turkey today is hardly the lockstep NATO partner it may have been in the past. Turkey is aggressively shaping the political and literal landscape around around it with its intervention in Syria, its association with Moscow, and that, of course, affects Turkey's relations with the West. My guests have been Middle East Institute and U.S. Institute for Peace analyst Dr. Graham Bannerman and an analyst with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Dr. Aykan Erdemir. Sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel, this is VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young. Join us next week for another edition of VOA Encounter.